This is the Seattle Public Library podcast of An Evening with Anoush Irani. Mr. Irani read from his new novel, The Song of Kahuncha, a story of poverty, violence, love, dreams, and childhood innocence. Mr. Irani was born and raised in Bombay, India. He moved to Vancouver, British Columbia in 1998. He is a playwright as well as a novelist. The Song of Kahuncha was a CBC Radio Canada Reads selection. He spoke June 21st at the Central Library.
Good evening, everyone. Karen is right. I do come from a line of storytellers, but none of them are writers. They're just people who loved getting drunk and telling stories over dinner. And as a child, that's what I remember most. I never used to read much when I was little, but I was always aware of the oral tradition of storytelling, which is very prominent in Indian culture. Every single person from the grandmother to the dog has a story, and I think I somehow picked that up. The Song of Kahuncha is the story of a 10-year-old boy named Chamdi who runs away from his orphanage in Bombay to find his father. But instead he gets thrust into the communal riots that took place in Bombay in the early 90s between the Hindus and the Muslims. And in a way, it is a story of what happens when hope meets hopelessness. Kahuncha is Chamdi's dream, and it means the city of no sadness. He dreams that one day all sadness will die, and Bombay will be reborn as Kahuncha, the city of no sadness. This novel came to me in the voice of a 10-year-old boy. I had finished writing my first novel, and I was making notes for what I wanted to do for the second one. I suddenly found myself writing in the voice of a 10-year-old boy. My name is Chamdi, I'm a boy of 10. And the image I had is that of a painfully thin boy who was trying to push his ribs back into his body. He was very embarrassed of the fact that his ribs stuck out of his chest, and he was trying to push them back in. And then I had the image of these ribs transforming into tusks. And Chamdi believes that one day his ribs will transform into tusks and they will become weapons of justice. So I found that idea interesting and I started playing with it. I eventually abandoned the voice of the 10-year-old because I didn't feel I wanted to pursue that in the novel. But I told the story from Chamdi's point of view in the third person. I'm going to read two sections for you this evening. The first one is when Chamdi, once he leaves the orphanage, he goes into the streets of Bombay and he befriends a boy named Sumdi, who's about 12 or 13 years old. He's a boy with polio. He's a street kid. And he's part of a street gang, which is operated by a gangster named Anandbhai. Anandbhai is someone who basically runs a gang of beggars. And I once read this article about this street gang of beggars in New Delhi, where they were actually sent to school. They were schooled in how to steal cell phones, how to steal wallets. It was a very professional get-up. And I loved the idea of, you know, this man teaching these children how to steal. I didn't love the idea, but I found it interesting. So in this part, Chamdi and Sumdi are going on the streets in the afternoon, and he's going to teach Sumdi, the boy with polio, is going to teach Chamdi how to beg for the first time. Chamdi follows Sumdi down the road. He spots a cow lazing on the footpath. A man walks past the cow carrying an air conditioner in his hand. The cow is in this man's way and he tries to shoo it away, but it does not budge. "Where are we going?" asks Chamdi. "To beg."
"To beg?"
"Maharaj, don't be so surprised. You're a man of the streets, no? So why is begging bad? Begging is the family business." "But what do we do?" "First, Chamdi, you tell me the truth."
"About what?"
"About where you are from. Otherwise, I will beat you on the head with my polio leg." "Do I have to beg you to tell me?" asked Sumdi. "We must not beg from each other. The enemy is out there, sitting in the taxis." "I'm from an orphanage," says Chamdi.
"What's that?"
"You don't know what an orphanage is?"
"Higher, I don't know."
"An orphanage is where they keep children without parents."
"Oh, there's another name for such a place."
"What?"
"Bombay," says Sumdi. You're smiling, but it's true. This city is our home, and it looks after us very badly. Anyway, at least you admitted that you're not from the road.
How did you know? Asked Chamri.
So many clues. Just look at your teeth, all clean, in one line, so well-mannered. It means you brushed them.
Yes,
see my teeth. Sumri opens his mouth wide and Chamri can see that his teeth are chipped and jagged. And they seem to grow on top of one another as if they are fighting for space. Chamri turns away because Sumri's breath is so strong.
Not a single day I have brushed my teeth, he says.
But don't be fooled. They might be yellow and eaten up, but I could snap your forearm into two if I wanted. Not that I would bite your forearm, but I would crack it if you challenge me.
No, I believe you, says Chamri.
But more than your teeth, your style gave you away.
My style of what?
You act like a prince. You think and then you speak. When I speak, the words just come out, like vomit. As they walk and talk, a juicewala's cart catches Chamri's eye. A plastic mixer containing orange juice rests on a glass case in which the oranges and mosambis are stored. Some of the oranges are arranged on top of the glass case. Chamri marvels at the manner in which these oranges stay balanced in the shape of a pyramid, as if the juicewala is some sort of juggler or circus man.
Now hope for a solid traffic jam, Sumri tells Chamri.
Why a jam?
So that cars are stuck and we have more time at the signals. Do I have to explain everything to you?
But it's still morning.
So?
So no traffic jam. In the orphanage, we could hear the sound of cars only in the afternoon.
What sort of place was this orphanage? What rubbish did they teach you there?
I learned how to read and write, says Chamri.
You can read and write?
Yes.
And are you proud of that?
Very proud.
That's of no use at all, you fool. When you go to the taxis to beg, they are not going to ask you, excuse me, can you spell your name, please?
What do I do?
You must act like you are really suffering.
But I am suffering.
Hero, this is Bombay. No one cares about the truth. The people want emotion, tears. Can you cry real tears?
On demand?
Yaar, I'm just playing with you, says Sumri. He places his hand on Chamri's shoulder and Chamri stops walking. In front of them, an old man opens the shutters to a small watch repair shop.
Now listen, says Sumri. There should be no shame in begging. We are smart boys. If life had been good to us, we would not be begging. No one will give us work, so we have to do this. No shame in begging.
Chamri notices that Sumri's tone has suddenly changed. His voice is softer, but firmer.
The tears will come anyway, trust me, he continues. I think of my father and that car going over him, and my mother running towards him, and I had to hold my sister because I was more afraid than she was. Neither of us went near the body. I think of my mother, how she sits in the darkness every night and pulls out her hair, and even though I think about this every day, the tears still come. Then he spits onto his palm, greases his hair with it, even though he hardly has any hair. In the sunlight, the scar on his face seems even darker, as though the skin has been removed inch by inch.
Even with this face, I can still look handsome, he says. You know how many movie offers I get when I go begging? But I always refuse. Who wants fame? Look around you. I can pull my pants down and let it go like a waterfall any time I want. How many movie stars can do that?
Chamri still stares at the scar. He knows it must make Sumri uneasy. The edges of the ear are jagged, like torn paper.
Sumri steps off the sidewalk and onto the main road.
Chamri watches his new friend trail a black and yellow taxi as it slows down for the red light. The taxi has no passenger.
Bhaiya, please give something, says Sumri to the taxiwala.
Hey, don't eat my brains early in the morning, says the taxiwala.
But if I have no food, then naturally I'll eat your brains, no?
Your tongue is sharp. Be careful or you'll cut yourself.
That's the problem. My tongue is so sharp that food is afraid to enter my mouth. Look how skinny I am.
You don't look skinny to me.
Look at what polio did to my leg.
What other sickness do you have? Asked the taxiwala.
Oh, I'm in love. Biggest illness.
Ha, says the taxiwala. He reaches into the pocket of his khaki shirt, takes out a 1 rupee coin and gives it to Sumri.
"For 1 rupee, what will I get?"
"You can get lost," says the driver. "I don't want to see your face again."
"Is next week okay?" asks Sumri.
The taxiwala smiles. As the light turns green, Sumri steps on the sidewalk again.
"That was very good," says Chamri.
"Stop congratulating me and go make some money."
"But I wanted to watch you first."
"You wanted to watch me? Me who cannot read or write?"
"I want to learn properly how to beg," says Chamri.
"Then you are my student from this moment."
"Done.
Show me some respect, you idiot. Call me sir."
"Sir."
"Now pay attention. First rule, never beg from taxiwalas."
"But you just did."
Sumri taps Chamri on the head with his knuckles.
"Don't argue with the master.
You rarely get money from taxiwalas, but this one's a regular. I have known him for 2 years now. Every day he takes the same route. When he's in a good mood, he gives. With the taxiwalas, you cannot use emotion, because their lives are just as hellish as ours. A little better, maybe. So they don't care about tears. And don't be stupid and tell them you can read and write, because maybe they cannot. At the same time, you don't want to make them feel that you are cleverer than them. You are a beggar, and beggars are meant to be brainless.
Okay, I will be brainless.
Sometimes it helps to act mentally disturbed, especially with delicate ladies. Cross your eyes and make strange sounds. Bang your head against the taxi a few times. Go close to the window and cough right into their faces. Guaranteed moneymaker.
Right.
Next are the lovebirds. You know what lovebirds are?
I think so. Explain to me.
Lovebirds are the boy girl. "What are you shy of? Lovebirds are beautiful."
That's what you must tell them.
"Look at you two. Forever you will be together like two beautiful birds."
"May you have many, many children," adds Chamri.
"No, never mention children," says Sumri.
"The boy will slap you. He doesn't want his girl to become bloated like a football. If he wants a football, he'll buy one. No children."
The best time to beg is when they are kissing. Keep on begging, keep on irritating. "Please give money, please give money, please give money." Keep on saying it until the boy gets fed up and gives you a 5 rupee note.
5 rupees?
Yes, love costs. Now the biggest item, the foreigner, man from other land. With these people, you have to use pity. Make sure your face is very dirty. Put spit all over your face underneath your eyes so it looks like you've been crying. Then go near the window and look directly into their eyes. It will be hard because they're always wearing sunglasses, but do it anyway. If they do not give money immediately, then say something like, "My father beats me. My mother is dying. My car is not working."
"My car is not working?"
Say anything, it doesn't matter. They have no idea what you're saying, most of them. But some of them are sharp and speak the language. Now there are many more types, but lessons for today are over. You may leave and go home.
"I'm already home," says Chamri. "The streets are my home for now."
"Wah, what a line, you're ready. Now go, go and earn some money." As Sumri limps away from Chamri, a van goes past and blows smoke on Sumri's face. Instead of shielding himself from the black smoke, Sumri inhales deeply. Then he turns to Chamri and shouts, "Take it all in, it will make your lungs strong." He starts coughing. "Coughing is a good way to get tears," he says, "to let smoke go in your eyes. Dirty your face, it's too clean, I wouldn't give you a single rupee. Stop walking like you own the world. Carry the world's weight on your shoulders. Trust me, boss, in a day or two you'll feel it anyway. And take that white scarf off your neck, Bombay is not a hill station." Then Sumri laughs, and Chamri feels it is a strange sight indeed to watch this boy walk with a limp, a face black from smoke, and the widest smile in the world. So that's one section where the two of them first go begging. And earlier on, when I was talking about oral storytelling, the next section shows how Chamri, this boy who has a great imagination, uses his imagination to survive. For everything that is negative, he constructs something positive. But the whole point of this book is ultimately the imagination wanes. When his dreams confront reality, that light dims, But by the end of the novel, when I was writing, my idea was to just retain a spark of hope. The fact that these children survive, I think that is a positive end. It is a hopeful end. Anything beyond that would not be truthful. And in a way, the book can be considered grim, but it is also hopeful because of the fact that these street children survive. And when I was in Bombay growing up, watching these street children, I found them to be very resilient and inspiring, because in spite of seeing so much pain, they would handle themselves with a lot of humor. A friend of mine runs a program called Dancing Feet. He's a choreographer and he teaches children how to dance. These are kids with HIV, they're kids with cancer, they're juvenile delinquents, they're children of sex workers, and he teaches them how to dance. And all the instructors who teach have to be trained, they have to go through workshops, because these kids are very sensitive, because some of them are on the verge of death. And during one such workshop, they were talking about death. And one 8-year-old boy said, you know, I don't want to talk about this. So we asked him why. He said, I know what death is. I've seen my mother burn herself right before my own eyes. So I know what death is. I just want to dance. You know, and that's the kind of strength that they have. They're extremely aware of everything around them. But I think they construct an escape route. They have to. Because they already know the reality that exists. But in Chamdi's case, he was from an orphanage. And he lived a rather sheltered life as compared to a lot of these street children. So when he's thrust into that atmosphere, I think it opens his mind completely. As I was saying, this next section, Sumri is, this is after they finished begging. It's very hot in the afternoon. They're on the street in a very busy part of Bombay. And Sumri is smoking a cigarette and he tells Chamdi, you know, I'm bored. Why don't you entertain me? Do something. Chamdi says, I will tell you a story. Now put on a show for me. Entertain me while I smoke so I feel like a king. Hurry up, do something. I will tell you a story, says Chamdi. Ah, I spit on stories. I will tell you my story. Oh, it will be a boring, well-mannered story just like you. Forget it, just sit down next to me. Chamdi looks for his box of matches. The cigarette is already in his mouth. At first, Chamdi wonders if he should pick a Chanda Mama story, one that he has read. But then he decides to invent his own story, because it hurts him when Sumri accuses him of having no imagination. Imagination is a private thing, but perhaps it is time to share his with his friend. Chamdi will tell his own story, but add and subtract a few minor details to make it worth a king's time. This is my story, Chamdi begins. It is called The Boy Whose Ribs Became Tusks and Left His Body. Sumri almost drops his match. Chamdi continues. By the time you finish smoking that cigarette, the story will be over. And if you like it, you will have to give me the money that I made today while begging. I accept the challenge, you poor fool, says Sumri. Chamdi begins. There once lived a boy who was very thin. Whenever he ate, his imagination used up all the food, because his mind was the strongest muscle, and he thought thoughts that no one else had the courage to think. Like what? Once more you interrupt me, I will turn your stiff leg into a hard whip that will give you 100 lashes. Now be quiet and listen. The boy dreamt of many things even though he was poor and had no parents. He dreamt of Bombay and how wonderful it was, and how people help each other and do not fight or steal. Each time he saw something horrible on the road, some act of cruelty, his ribs would stick out more. And at first the boy did not understand this at all. Why are my ribs sticking out? He would ask himself. But one day his ribs spoke to him. His ribs said, "We are not ribs, we are tusks, and we are here to change the world." And the boy told his ribs to shut up, because what if someone were to notice his ribs talking? But he had no control over his ribs in the same way people seem to have no control over their cruel actions. One day when the boy was walking on the road, he saw another boy who had polio. And that wasn't the only thing wrong with the boy. It seemed as if the polio boy had no brains at all, because he was smoking too. But he was good at heart. And just then a horrible man, a gangster named Anand Bhai, came to this polio boy, took out a knife and said, whatever money you make is mine. And this brave polio boy tried to put up a fight. He fought like a tiger with one bad leg, but still Anand Bhai was winning. And then suddenly the boy of the ribs noticed that his ribs were starting to tear out of his body. They became sharp like elephant tusks and shot out through his chest, but the boy felt no pain. And a tusk flew out and plunged itself in Anand Bhai's back and told him, "Leave this polio boy alone, he is a friend of the tusks." And Anand Bhai ran away like a madman with a tusk in his back. After that, all the horrible people were chased by tusks. Like that Muchad, who owns the bakery, a tusk came straight at him and smashed through the glass of his bakery and said, "Give bread to the beggars, otherwise next time I will land in your throat." And this continued until the bad people realized their mistakes. And then finally the tusks flew back into the owner boy's body, satisfied that the people had changed. Although Sumdi's cigarette is burnt almost all the way down, he has not taken a single puff. His mouth is slightly open and he stares at Chamdi. But Chamdi is silent because he is catching his breath and hoping that such a thing is possible, that his ribs can indeed become weapons that protect the good. Chamdi looks at his ribs and the skin that covers them and how they gleam in the sun as though they are tusks. But what if he is the biggest fool in the universe for inventing magic where none exists? In a city where he has only heard cries of pain and not a single cry of joy. Thank you.